Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Forever Engine by Frank Chadwick, narrated by Gildert Jackson. Now I am become Death, the Destroyer of Worlds. Robert Oppenheimer, July 16, 1945, quoting the Hindu scripture Bhagavad Gita, upon seeing the Trinity atomic bomb test. Chapter 1. August 2, 2018, Wessex, England. Reggie Llewellyn was the most casual killer I ever met, but I didn't hold that against him. If I'd known he was behind the trip to England, you couldn't have gotten me on the plane at gunpoint. Not because of who he was, but what he represented. But I didn't know. Not until it was too late. My internal alarm started sounding from the moment I walked in the front entrance of WECOL, the Wessex High Energy Collider Facility. I expected an overweight, white-shirted rent-a-cop guarding a civilian research complex out in the sleepy English countryside. Instead, I faced four hard-eyed soldiers, dressed in camo fatigues and packing assault rifles. Their stares followed me in unison as I crossed the polished marble floor. But I looked straight back at them. If they wanted to intimidate someone, they'd have to wait for the next guy through the door. Well, maybe I was a little intimidated, but the trick is never to show it. I'd barely cleared security when a greeting echoed through the foyer. "Jack Fargo! There you are!" Although I hadn't heard it for a decade, I recognized Reggie's voice at once, and I knew nothing here was what it seemed. We shook hands, and Reggie beamed at me. Reggie always beamed, sort of crazy that way. My anxiety at seeing him was mixed up with some pleasure as well, and that surprised me. Lots of surprises that day, and more to come. Unlike the guards, he wore a pressed service uniform. He wasn't much different from the young subaltern I'd known in Afghanistan. Deeper laugh lines around the eyes, hair clipped shorter, mustache showing some gray in the jet black, and different rank insignia on his shoulder straps. Well, he looked a little jumpy, too, which I'd never seen in him before. "They made you a major, Reggie? The British Empire is doomed." "The Empire's been finished for some time," he said. "If your education system were better over there, you might have noticed. How have you been? I was quite sorry to hear about your wife and, well..." The sudden tightness in my throat surprised me. "I'm okay. Tough time. My daughter, Sarah, and I got through it together." Reggie nodded in sympathy. "I'm glad to hear that. Well, then..." He gestured down the broad marble corridor into the facility, and we walked side by side. I didn't know what was really going on here yet, but decided my best play was to play along with the original premise of my trip and see where that led me. "So let me get this right," I said. "You started digging the foundations for a new wing and stumbled on some possible Roman artifacts? Not that I'm complaining, but why fly a historian all the way from Illinois to evaluate a cultural resource site? Isn't Cambridge around here somewhere?" "Oxford is closer, actually, but it's a fair question. Some discretion in this matter is required. When I realized we might have need of someone conversant with ancient history, I recalled that you are a very discreet fellow. More than that, I know you will tell me the truth with neither fear nor favour. You are honest to a fault, as I recall." "So I've been told. Thank God for academic tenure, huh?" "Yes, we don't have that in the army. Fortunately, excessive honesty is not a failing from which I suffer." He grinned that toothy grin, the one that looked like a tiger about to make a kill. Reggie and I had worked well together a long time ago, but there were good reasons I had chosen academia instead of a more active career. These days, my most vicious fights were over who was going to be the next departmental chair. Reggie knew a surprising amount about my post-military career. That made me nervous. We stopped in an open, well-lit but deserted office area. "The technical staff is preparing for another test," Reggie explained. "We do these mostly at night, when the clerical staff is gone." He studied me for a moment, as if deciding how to open the conversation. He took a clear plastic coin case from his trouser pocket and handed it to me. "Give me your professional opinion of this." Since the Brits had brought me a long way at some expense, I took my time studying the coin, but I pegged it in about 2 seconds. "Roman silver denarius, 1st century CE, reign of Emperor Galba, supposedly." "Supposedly? Well, it's a counterfeit. A really good one. Too good, actually. It looks as if it were struck last year, not over 1900 years ago." "But other than that, you'd say it was authentic?" he asked. "No, the inscription places it from the 3rd year of the region of Galba. The thing is, Galba's reign only lasted about 7 months before he was killed and replaced by Otho." I handed the coin back. "Weren't coins ever struck in anticipation of an event?" he asked. "Not a couple of years in anticipation, and especially by Galba. About the only thing memorable about him was his stinginess." "You're certain, Jack? I brought you in on this because people tell me you're one of the top men on Roman coins these days. I need to know. Are you absolutely certain?"
"Yep, 100%.
Lost in thought, Reggie frowned at the coin in his hand and said nothing. "What gives?" I said. "You didn't fly me here from Chicago to tell you what any Roman numismatist could." "It is not counterfeit." I started to insist otherwise, but stopped. What was an American historian really doing in a British high-energy physics lab guarded by armed soldiers, looking at a phony silver coin that wasn't phony? Had to be, but wasn't. Reggie wasn't worried about disturbing a cultural resource site, and suddenly I had absolutely no curiosity about what he really wanted. "Well, sorry I couldn't be more help. Give me a ring next time you're in the States, Reggie, and I'll buy you a drink. I can find my own way out." He laughed. "You know it's not that simple." "Sure it is. Because I don't know anything yet, and I intend to keep it that way. You asked for my professional opinion. I gave it to you. Adios, muchacho." "It is not counterfeit." "Oh, fuck you, Reggie. My daughter starts her freshman year of college in 3 weeks. I don't know what sort of cloak and dagger Indiana Jones bullshit you've got going on here, but whatever it is, it's not my department. I used to be an army translator. That's it. Now I'm a historian and a single parent, and I have things that need doing. You aren't on my list." "Of course I understand how you must feel, Jack. But before you say anything, why not have a seat and read these papers? Please." He held out a folder with the seal of the U.S. Department of the Army. Son of a bitch. I'd been set up. I snatched it, sat at an empty desk, and found nothing surprising in the folder. My change of status from unassigned reserve to active duty, with a pay grade of W-4, recertification of my top-secret security clearance, and orders assigning me to temporary duty with Wimbish Detachment, Military Provost Guard Service, Major Reginald Llewellyn commanding. Provost Guard Service, my ass. Reggie was SAS, the British Elite Special Operations Force, and I figured the 4 goons at the front door were as well. The last document was the British Official Secrets Act form. I scribbled my signature, the date, and handed the folder back.
I'm out of the world-fixing business, Reggie. If I'm not back in time to take Sarah to college, I will have your ass, SAS or not. He beamed and took the folder. Imagine how terrified that makes me. Then the smile left his face. The question of who would actually have whose ass may be academic, however. What did you just call it, the world-fixing business? Believe me, Jack, you do not appreciate how apropos a term like that is. If we are not successful, there is a distinct possibility our world, as we know it, will not survive. I studied him for a moment, but he didn't look like he was trying to snow me. He looked a little frightened. I'd never seen him look frightened before. Okay, you've got my attention. Here's the deal. I'll help you out on this, but I will not, under any circumstances, do anything I will be ashamed to tell my daughter. Is that understood? Assuming we live through this, I wouldn't recommend telling her anything, old man. The Official Secrets Act. Fuck the Official Secrets Act. His eyebrows rose a bit at that, but then he smiled ruefully. Very well. Conditions understood and accepted, and you'll be happy to know that we won't be jetting anywhere to do our work, or have any annoying people shooting at us. That is not the sort of danger we face. No one knows what we are doing here. Yeah, including me. So what are you doing? He sat in the chair beside the desk and looked at me for a moment. It's something of a time machine, I suppose, he said. A time machine? Bullshit. I hardly believe it myself. It wasn't meant to be. It was intended as a weapon, very hush-hush. I don't completely understand how it was supposed to work. Something about quantum tunneling projectiles going straight through the earth without actually touching it, that sort of thing. I suppose that's all academic now, in any case, because that's not what happened. When they test-fired the device, it sent the projectile out as planned, but instead of it appearing at the target point, a different object appeared back here at the launch site. And what happened to the projectile? I said. No idea. As far as we can tell, it simply vanished. They've done quite a number of test fires. The projectile always disappears. The accelerator brings back a small, solid object, sometimes rock, sometimes a molten slug of metal, but sometimes an intact artifact. Artifacts from the past, Jack. Artifacts from our past, we thought. Until this. Reggie tapped the coin with his finger. I looked at it again, looked at the coin from the third year of a reign which, in our world, had lasted only 6 months. For a moment, blood pounded in my ears. The room spun. I leaned back in the chair and held its arms to steady myself, breathing slowly and evenly. This can't be right. A time machine? A different past? How do you know all that? Maybe it's just a movie prop you snagged by accident from the Fox backlot. I understand how you feel. Honestly, I doubt you can say anything I didn't say myself when I first heard about all this. If you want the technical explanation of radioactive decay dating in something I think they call electron cloud shift, one of the boffins can trot it all out for you later. I don't really understand any of it myself, but I know when people are lying and when they absolutely believe they are telling the truth. You do as well, don't you? Well, these scientists are telling the truth, and they are frightened. I stared at the coin. Emperor Galba, huh? Okay, if it's not from our past, then what gives? Of course, there are many theories, as there are boffins, circular time, infinite universe, but the most dangerous, the one we must act on, is that someone else has accessed the past, perhaps someone from our future, or perhaps even us, and either deliberately or inadvertently altered it. I shook my head. No way. We still remember our past. We still have museums full of artifacts from it. How can the past change and the present stay the same? Well, of course it cannot, but the theory involves a temporal event wave. If you drop a rock in a pond on one side, its effects are not felt immediately on the opposite shore, but eventually they reach there. The notion is a change in the past takes time, whatever that means in this context, to manifest its effects in the present, that it moves forward through time, destroying the presents it passes through and replacing them with the alternate. The wave simply has not yet reached us. But when it does, his voice trailed off. Everything changes, I said. But we won't know it changes. As far as we know, it will always have been like that, right? It's more than that, I'm afraid. My mother was married before she married my father. Her first husband, who, as far as I know, she loved very much, fell down the steps of the church as they emerged on their wedding day, broke his neck and died. Several years later, she met my father, married, and I am the result. But had her first husband not found his death in remarkably unlikely circumstances, I would never have existed. Someone else would have, in all likelihood, but not me. I don't believe in predestination, Jack. Although we've never spoken of anything so esoteric, I don't think you believe in it either, or you would not behave the way I have seen you do. Men like us believe we make our own destiny, to the extent we're able, and for everything beyond that the gods roll the dice, leaving aside whether someone else would have saved your life in Coast that one time, had I not been in the world. What is the likelihood you would exist at all? How many times in your ancestry, stretching back thousands of years, do you suppose a future hinged on whether a man looked to his right and saw the love of his life, or to his left and saw the woman he settled for instead? The gods rolled the dice, Jack, and as a result of all those rolls, here we are. But change something, and aside from its direct effects, the table is cleared, the game begins anew, and all those dice are rolled again. What are the chances they will all come up exactly the same? And what if even one of them is different? No. When this temporal event wave passes, it may leave a world full of people, but they will be entirely different people. I cannot conceive that you or I or anyone we know and love will actually be among them, no matter how much some of them may coincidentally resemble us. We will all be dead. Well, we will never have existed, but I'll let the philosophers argue that distinction in whatever time they have left. To me it amounts to the same thing. It was a terrifying prospect. Or at least would have been if I believed any of it. Wave effects taking time to move through time, theories spun on top of other theories, none of it was real. But across the desk, Reggie absent-mindedly tapped the plastic coin case. That damned coin was real. I felt sweat on my forehead. What if? The lights dimmed for a moment and came back up. I heard a soft chime from somewhere deeper in the facility. Ah, Reggie said, firing up the accelerator for tonight's test shot. They're sending something really large back this time, so we'll see what we get in return. The white lab coats think there's some sort of conversation of matter and energy thingy at work. We send something back and automatically displace an equivalent mass here to keep things in balance. How long have we got if this wave effect theory is real? I asked. We don't know, but they're playing with different settings, power and that sort of thing, trying to find as many artifacts from different times as possible and see if they match our expectations or if... Well, They are somehow different. And you want me to look at whatever shows up here.
Precisely. We need you to look for historical discrepancies like this coin. We have a few other historians I'll introduce you to shortly, but to my mind, you're the key, Jack. You see, you always had an eye for detail, for little things not quite right, and a preternatural ability to see relationships no one else could. That's why we really need you here. First, to find out how much time we have, and then to help formulate a plan. If someone has altered our past, we need to change it back, and I suspect we will have only one opportunity to do so.
I sat back and thought about that, and I didn't much like it. This was their plan? Poke around, see what turned up, and hope I could pull a quantum rabbit out of the hat? Jesus Christ!
He drew a polished metal flask from his pocket, took a drink, and handed it to me. I noticed his hand trembled as he did so. I'd never seen Reggie's hand shake. I took a long pull. Irish. Reggie always preferred Irish to Scotch.
"If I'm going to do this," I said, "I need to talk to someone from the physics side, someone who can explain things in English instead of foot-long equations on a blackboard. I'll need to see the existing artifacts as well. Presumably you have a database started?"
"Yes."
"Okay. I need to know the plan, the logic of their search for artifacts, and see if we can tweak that to get better results.
Well, that's a start."
"Right. I'll go find the others, introduce you to the team, your team." I knew you were the right man for this.
He rose and turned to leave.
"One more thing, Reggie. I want to call Sarah. My phone's not going to screw anything up, is it?"
"No, certainly not, but you may have trouble getting a signal once the accelerator starts, so I call now."
He left through a door opposite the side we'd entered, and I took out my phone. "Call Sarah." I heard the line ring at the other end 3 times, and then she answered, voice foggy with sleep.
"Hello?"
"Hey, kiddo, it's just me. Sorry I woke you."
Dad?"
"Yeah, go back to sleep. I just called to let you know I'm safe and sound and to tell you I love you." The sleepiness vanished from her voice.
"Dad, what's wrong?"
"Nothing. Everything's fine. The lights dimmed again, more this time, and flickered. The phone crackled, the connection starting to break up. I can't hear you, honey. The connection." My phone sounded the 3 quick beeps of a dropped call. The lights came back up, brighter than before, and an alarm chimed from deep within the facility. I started to redial, but the phone just displayed the searching for service message. Reggie burst back through the door, looking confused and alarmed.
"Something's gone wrong," he said. "I'm not sure what, but you'd better go back to the front entrance for now."
I slipped the phone in my pocket and started to stand. The world turned white, unbearably hot. The thundering roar of dying atoms and molecules tore through every nerve in my body and drowned out my scream of agony, and all I could think was, "The Event Wave!"
Chapter 2. Somewhere in England. I lay in bed, my eyes bandaged. Those bandages on my eyes frightened me more than anything else, more than the waves of pain that washed over me and made me cry out and try to sit up. Someone spoke, someone pricked my arm, the pain left, and for a while I floated in a narcotic fever dream. In the dream, Sarah needed a bigger bed. I got one of those kits from IKEA, and Tommy Nash, my platoon sergeant, came over to help. We had the parts spread all over the floor, trying to figure out which peg G went into which socket M, while Sarah stood in the doorway watching. She was small, though, only about 6 years old, with short brown hair like mouse fur. How could she go to college when she was so tiny? After 10 minutes, she asked,
"How many hillbillies does it take to put together a bed?"
I laughed and grabbed for her, but she ran away, giggling. I turned back to Tommy, but he was dead, his legs blown off by an RPG round. He lay on the riverbank, and his blood stained the water of the Daria Yer, helmand pink, but only for about 10 meters downstream. Then it turned back to the same muddy brown as always, and you'd never even know he'd been there. Then I was back in the bed of pain. People spoke to me. I answered, but don't remember what I said or if it made any sense. Probably not. Eventually my senses sharpened, and I asked whoever was there not to give me any more of the pain medication. Hard to do. I liked the meds, had started looking forward to my shots. The more my thinking cleared, the less everything around me made sense. Where was I? What had happened to me? I couldn't see because of the bandages, but what did my other senses tell me? I was still in England. The nurse's rural accents were barely intelligible, and the food was terrible. The fare that morning, stewed kidney paste on toast, smelled like urine. Who but the Brits would eat that stuff? The scent of alcohol, soap, and another strong chemical I couldn't place hung in the air, but I didn't hear any of the normal background noises, PA systems, monitor beeps. The breeze brushing my face and the smell of flowers meant an open window instead of central air. That was odd. And just as odd, they actually injected the pain medication with hypodermics. Why not just add it to my IV drip? No IV drip. Maybe I was in better shape than I thought. A doctor, older fellow from his voice, talked with me about my burns. My back and upper arms would scar, but not my face. My hair was already growing back. They expected my eyesight to recover, though they wouldn't know for certain until the bandages came off. I asked about Reggie and the others. He declined to discuss any other cases, but only after enough of a hesitation to make me fear the worst. Had my daughter been notified? The doctor didn't know, but promised he'd look into it. A police inspector interviewed me. Beyond the large explosion, he had no idea what had happened. I couldn't fill him in, not without going to prison for violation of the Official Secrets Act, but I told him I'd talk to someone from military intelligence out of London. I repeated my request twice before he got it. Apparently, the British police did not reserve their most intellectually promising officers for service in rural Wessex. The doctor removed the bandages from my eyes the next day. Even through blurry eyes, my surroundings looked wrong. No monitors. The bed wasn't adjustable, just a brass poster with no railings to restrain restless patients. The nurses wore long sleeves, long dresses, and long hair tucked up under little round white caps. Maybe a private Mennonite hospital? Yeah, maybe. But that damned coin suggested an alternative. I tried to avoid dwelling on the implications, but couldn't. Had there really been an event wave passage? Was I in an altered world? And if so, how altered? But if the world had really changed, why did I remember the way it had been? Why weren't my memories changed? No, none of that made sense. The military intelligence guy showed up the following day. A slender, dark-haired captain in his late 20s named Gordon, in his own words, sent out from horse guards. My vision had improved to about 80% or so. He wore a red uniform tunic and dark blue trousers, like the foot guards in front of Buckingham Palace. Why send someone from the guards? Why wear the ceremonial uniform? And besides, the horse guards were blue, not red. I had learned enough British history to remember the horse guards barracks once housed the headquarters of the British Army. Horse guards had been shorthand for Army headquarters, but not for the last 100 years. So maybe that had changed, or not changed, I guess. Gordon started.
You understand. Sample complete. Ready to continue?